Minority Report is one of the most chillingly accurate portrayals of the future that Hollywood has ever created. In one of his greatest works of all time, Steven Spielberg shows us a truly unique dystopia of government surveillance and advanced facial recognition. But the most important part of the story is the pre-crime division, a futuristic branch of police that can see into the future and arrest people before they've even broken the law. Underneath the stunning cinematography, underrated action sequences, and the well-paced story, Minority Report asks us some really important questions. The most obvious theme is the nature of free will and whether we actually have any choice in what we do. That isn't all though. The film beautifully sets up one of the most terrifying dystopias we've ever seen. It's all in the background details, helped along by the fact that most of the characters just accept it as part of life. But to peel back the layers and figure out what Minority Report is really telling us, we need to go straight into the story. Despite how complicated the concepts are, it never really feels that way when you're watching the film. A big reason is the opening to the film, which sets up the premise and the plot so naturally you can barely even notice the exposition. The movie begins and we see a man and his wife getting ready in the morning. It soon becomes clear that she's cheating on him. As the scene continues though, we also see how the pre-crime division actually works. Three people called precogs have, through a dangerous experiment, been given the ability to see future murders. The pre-crime division keeps them sedated and hooked up to a machine. Every time they see a future crime, the machine tells the police the victim's name, the perpetrator, and the time that it will happen. The rest comes in fragments, which the chief of the pre-crime division, John Anderton, can piece together himself. It's worth mentioning that this is one of Tom Cruise's best performances. Both the range of emotions and how he changes over time is perfectly delivered. Getting back to the future murder on screen though, and it's clearly a crime of passion. John Anderton and his team's job is to figure out where the crime will take place and get there before it happens. We see how tight the time frame is. John only gets there a split second before the man would have killed his wife. It's a perfect example to set up how it all works. We see John catch the man's arm just before the fatal blow. It makes it indisputable that he was going to go through with the murder, but even then, it still feels wrong on a gut level. Technically, he hadn't actually committed a crime yet. Despite the fact that he would have been guilty a second later, he was and still is innocent of murder. This gut feeling only gets worse when we find out what they do to the people who get charged with future crimes, but that only gets shown later on, back at the pre-crime division headquarters, and the film shows us more of how everything actually works. For 6 years, they've maintained a flawless reputation. The murder rate has decreased by 90%, and planned murders are pretty much a thing of the past.
Just 1 month under the pre-crime program, the murder rate in the District of Columbia was reduced 90%.
Everyone knows they get caught now. So far, the program has been limited to Washington, D.C., but there are plans to extend it to the rest of the country. It's put the whole division under scrutiny. It's why Danny Whitwer, an agent for the Department of Justice, has been given a warrant to investigate. He sees the precogs having an echo where they re-experience one of the future murders they've seen. It's the first hint there might be something slightly wrong in the system. Living in a world like this, where everything is tracked, your data and privacy is exploited, isn't just some future prediction. It's our current reality today, and data brokers are exploiting your personal information without you ever knowing. Which is why I want to tell you about our video sponsor, Aura. And it's a really important time to be talking about them, because hackers may have stolen the social security numbers of every American. You see, over 2.9 billion records were stolen from National Public Data, which provides personal information to employers and others doing background checks. These stolen records include a person's full name, address, date of birth, phone number, and most importantly, social security number. And members of the hacker group have reportedly released this information for free online. I don't know about you, but this makes me incredibly uncomfortable. The fact that just a random group of people can hack into this database and suddenly get all your personal information just like that is a really terrifying thing to think about. So if you weren't taking precautions with your personal information online before, this should be a huge wake-up call. You've never been more vulnerable online than you are right now. But I'm not too worried, because I use Aura. Aura monitors your personal data, including your social security number, across billions of data points like the dark web and public court records, to detect and alert you to potential identity theft. They give you up to $5 million in identity theft insurance should the worst case scenario happen. They also provide a bunch of other features to keep you safe online, all inside one app. You can use my link, aura.com/moon, to try 14 days for free. That'll be enough time for Aura to find out if any of your personal information has been exposed. I highly recommend you do this right now, because not only is National Public Data not going to do anything to help you, but they probably won't even face any repercussions for this leak. And I don't want to leave myself and my family vulnerable to data breaches. And if you don't want this either, you can go to aura.com/moon to try 2 weeks for free. Next, we get a little insight into John Anderton. He's a troubled man, struggling to deal with the disappearance of his son and the resulting breakup of his marriage. It gives us an insight into why he's so effective at his job, and why he's so eager to believe in the system. Because for him, it's personal. He deals with this loss by taking drugs that helps him relive his memories, or watching them on a futuristic tape player. It's just one of the film's many ironies that the chief of the pre-crime division is stuck living in the past. It's in the next scene, though, that we get a more clear view of how the Society of Minority Report sees the future. The detective acts as a proxy for the audience here. He asks the same questions that we've already been asking. How can it be possible that precogs know someone will definitely kill someone else? How can they be sure that it's only possibility? Chief Anderton explains it to him by rolling a ball along the table. When the detective catches it, he asks him why. And when the detective responds by saying it would fall, it seems to prove Anderton's and the government's view. It was a certainty that the ball would have fallen. That was its only possible future at some point in time. Just because the pre-crime division steps in to stop a crime, it doesn't mean it was going to happen in the first place. It mirrors a philosophical view called determinism. In a nutshell, it says that the universe works like a train on a railway track. It's always locked into going one direction. Everything that happens in the future is guaranteed to happen, and nothing else could have happened instead. A consequence of this is that it makes free will much harder to imagine. The idea that we make our own choices gets rid of that. If determinism is true, then everything we've done and everything we will do is already fixed. The opposite view is that there's lots of different ways the future could happen. In this view, the universe is random, and we do have some influence over our own choices. It's clear though that in the world of Minority Report, people assume there's only one possible future. The precogs and their perfect, predictive ability seems to prove it. It still leaves a lot of problems with future crimes though. A famous problem with determinism is that if it's true, then it can mean that nobody is actually guilty of any crimes. Everyone's future is fixed, including criminals. It was their destiny to commit the crime for reasons completely outside of their control. In a determinist world, it seems like we're actually completely powerless. It might feel like we're making decisions, but there was actually only ever one thing we were gonna do. The fact that the pre-crime division is interfering only makes things less clear. None of the people they've detained for murder are actually guilty of it. The precogs might seem like the most unrealistic part of the film, but there's plenty of examples of our own governments arresting and imprisoning people for crimes they might have committed in the future. Guantanamo Bay is just a perfect example of this. 780 people have been sent there, but only 8 of them have ever actually been formally accused of any crimes. Instead, it's their connections to insurgent groups and their probable intentions which have put them there. Now, the US government knew that they were, on the whole, mostly innocent, but because of the risk they posed to other people's safety and the information they might have, the government imprisoned them anyway. It's impossible to tell how many lives were saved by this. It could be none at all, or it could be hundreds of thousands. The more authoritarian a government is, the more they embrace a deterministic view of the world, as it helps enable them to control people's lives, as they try to replace people's futures with their own fixed path. In Minority Report, they could step in directly, but obviously this isn't really possible in our world. Instead, we've been seeing the rise of AI as a way to predict and stop crimes. By feeding specialized programs all the criminal data for a city, the model can spit out areas where crimes are most likely and tell the police where to put their officers.
In predictive policing, data-centered analytical techniques powered by algorithms can help officers identify where and when crime is most likely to occur. Predpol is one of the largest companies in this space, and they use 3 data points: crime type, location, and time and date, to build customized crime predictions.
But it can also work on a more personal level. Credit card companies already feed your purchase history into AI. They can then use the pattern recognition to spot fraudulent transactions. Now that the technology exists, it's only a matter of time before it gets used in other, more troubling ways. In the future, AI might be able to read people's personal data and predict what crimes they're likely to commit. Authoritarian regimes already imprison people for no reason whatsoever. It's only a matter of time before they start aiming their arrests with AI instead. But as we get deeper into the movie, it will soon become clear that the pre-crime division is just one tool for a totalitarian government that determines every part of people's lives. Whitworth's introduction to the program, as well as the audience's, ends with a tour of the room where they keep the precogs. But after they've left, one of the precogs called Agatha grabs Anderton, while going through a flashback to a previous murder. It bothers John enough to investigate it by traveling to the prison where all the people they've arrested are being kept. It's a really chilling scene when you think about it. Instead of keeping them in cells like a normal jail, all the people have been put into a coma. Throughout the movie, we get hints that it's a truly awful experience. It's never really explained, but it does seem like it puts people into a never-ending nightmare. At the start of the film, the potential murderer is terrified of it, and later on in the film, John compares it to hell.
You're right now with Halo, but people will still believe in pre-crime.
The fact that they call the tool that does it to Halo definitely leans into the idea of a biblical punishment. But John isn't there to check on all the people he condemned to that fate. Instead, he's there to take a look at the archive of murders, specifically the one that Angela the Precog was having flashbacks to. Despite it apparently being a perfect system, her version of events is suspiciously missing. What's more, there also aren't any details on Anne Lively, who would have been the victim of the murder. It seems like she too just disappeared, incredibly strange in a world where computers track everywhere you go. John doesn't have too much time to think about it, but he does ask the director of the pre-crime division about it. It's clear the two are close, they're both at the center of the pre-crime program. In fact, he puts the pressure back on John's inability to deal with his loss, and leads back onto his belief in the program and the system. Back at the headquarters, another murder has been foreseen. This time it's a planned one. Everything seems normal at first, and we see the process in more detail. As he's working, two legal officials dial in to rubber stamp the process. It's worth noticing how quick this process seems. Guilt is obviously assumed in the same way that oppressive governments have always sentenced people without proper trials. It turns out that the victim's name this time is Leo Crow, but as the murder scene gets clearer, we see the face of the killer. It's John himself. He quickly hides this startling truth from his colleague and tries to learn more about the murder he's apparently destined to commit. But as he's trying to leave, Whitworth corners him in the elevator. He's been poking around John's apartment and he finds the drugs he's been taking. But when he accuses him of it, John takes it to mean he knows about the future murder. Whitworth is confident that he's got him, even when John pulls a gun on him. He's confident he's safe because the system would have seen his imminent death. That is until the alarm goes off. While it's just a signal that John is now a fugitive, Whitworth thinks it's proof that John intends to shoot him. The way the blood drains from Whitworth's face is one of the best bits of acting in a film that's already full of great performances. It gives John the opportunity to escape and leave in his car. He calls the director on the way, but halfway through, the car locks down and tries to take John back to get arrested. He escapes the car on the vertical road in an amazing action sequence, although they're soon onto him again. John's old colleagues corner him in an alleyway, but he knows all of their tricks. It lets him surprise them and escape in a jetpack chase through an apartment building. It's yet another great sequence, made even better by Spielberg's signature use of small details. There's the little scene where one of the jetpacks perfectly cooks some burger sitting on a grill, or the fact that John makes sure one of his old team won't fall to their death before leaving them behind. Eventually, the detective catches up to John and chases him through an automated car factory, but John makes another miraculous escape, driving off in a newly built car. Some of the greatest strengths of Minority Report are the small details and the world building. It makes everything much easier to understand, and each conversation can focus on the important bits like character development instead. You can easily get caught up in the pace of the film, but when you take a look at those details, they show a government that has almost complete control over people's lives. Just take the car sequence. It only happens because John's car gets locked down by the police. It means the government in Minority Report has the power to take anyone's car whenever they want. They can essentially kidnap whoever they please. Unless you're an action movie star and you can escape like John does, you'd be powerless to do anything other than wait for your fate. The same thing would technically be possible with any self-driving cars in our world. If people would accept it, then any government could do this. It's similar to how governments are in constant battle with tech companies to give them backdoors into people's phones. Taking control of people's cars as well is just a few steps further down the line, especially with the rise of electric cars. Then there are the eye scanners. In Minority Report, there are cameras everywhere which use them to identify people and create a map of where everyone is. It's not something people have implants for either. They can tell who anyone is based on their pupils. We see the police use it to find John instantly when he's on the run. It means the government is passively tracking everyone. This pretty much already happens in our world today as well, although it's far harder to notice. Instead of scanning people's eyes, they tell where people are based on the different signal towers their phones connect to. That already gives them a rough idea, and with GPS data, they can make it far more accurate. Facial recognition software is the next step. It's arguably even worse than the eye scanners in Minority Report. You don't need to let them scan you, simply not wearing a mask is enough. In our world, it's even being combined with a version of pre-crime. Lots of shops in the UK already use it through a company called Facewatch to keep track of known shoplifters. If the store cameras ever see one, a silent alarm goes off and they get escorted out by security. They might not have actually stolen anything for years, but once you're in the system, it effectively bans you from all the shops using it. Minority Report predicted so many different things about our world, and 20 years later, nearly all of this has come true. We haven't even covered the invasive, personalized adverts in the film, yet another prediction that's come true. But unlike a lot of dystopias, it's not just a depressing warning about things to come. It also tells the story of a man who learned the truth and uprooted the oppression oppressive system which he used to believe in. The next place that John searched for answers takes him is the home of the woman who supposedly created the Precox. But as we're going to find out, it was more like an experiment gone wrong than a discovery. She's one of the more interesting side characters in the movie, and she eventually tells John about the flaw in the system. Sometimes when the Precox see a crime, they don't agree on the outcome. Sometimes the most gifted of the three, Agatha, has a different version of events.
Most of the time, all three precognitives will see an event in the same way, but once in a while, one of them will see things differently than the other two.
It's what's called a minority report, and if the public found out about them, it would destroy the system's image of perfection. It's also, however, the only way that John can prove his innocence. But first, he needs to get to Agatha and bypass the thousands of scanners in his way. He goes back to an alley surgeon who specializes in eye transplants for people who've been flagged by the system. It's a great scene with a perfect mixture of humor and tension. The surgeon jabs John with anesthesia when he isn't looking, has no rules for hygiene whatsoever, and he also reveals John had previously arrested him years before, landing him in prison. And on top of all of that, after the operation, John has to keep his eyes shut for 12 hours, otherwise he'll go blind.
Don't take the bandages off for 12 hours.
If you take them off before then, you'll go blind.
We also learn about how John lost his son at a public pool after he went underwater for just a few seconds. Halfway through the 12 hours, the police arrive and search the building with these creepy spider drones that look for fugitives by scanning people's eyes. It forces John to hide underwater in a bathtub, just like when he lost his son. The cinematography really makes this whole sequence so much better. It's shot in a really unique way that you just don't see in more recent films. Eventually they find him and John is forced to surface for air. After they scan him, it leaves him blind in one eye. But at least the police move on thinking he's someone else. The operation clearly worked. It lets him walk straight past all the eye scanners in the city, then he uses his old eyes to get straight into his old workplace to kidnap Agatha. But he soon gets discovered by the police halfway through the kidnap attempt, but it doesn't matter. They also just learn that Agatha is present for the murder that John will apparently commit. It means he's always going to get away, at least according to their deterministic thinking. While narrowly dodging attempts to apprehend him, John takes Agatha to a seedy business where they let people live out whatever fantasies they want. There he convinces the owner to use the devices to scan Agatha's visions and learn more about the crimes he's meant to commit in half an hour. But to John's horror, he doesn't have a minority report. It seems like John is guaranteed to commit the murder they've predicted, but just after he learns this, Agatha has another vision, this time of what looks like the murder of Anne Lively again. It was the one that started the whole mess in the first place, but before he has a chance to think about it, the police are on him again. This time he only manages to escape because of Agatha's knowledge of the future. She tells him exactly what to do to get away, and happens to lead him right to where the murder is meant to take place. John then goes to confront Crow, the man he's meant to murder, not to kill him, but because he still thinks he has the key to getting back his old life again. When he goes to the room though, the bed is covered in photos of his son. At first it seems like the vision led him right to his son's kidnapper. John is filled with rage and the desire to finally get the revenge he's been wanting for so many years. But when Crow appears in the room, John points his gun at him. It's the key moment in the film that everything hinges on. John can see the seconds counting down to what seems like his destiny, but at the final moment, he changes his mind. It's all too perfect, he's been set up, and Crow isn't the man who kidnapped his son. It's important because it proves that free will does exist in this world. John breaks the prediction and the pre-crime system is proved wrong, something that never should have been able to happen. Crow then starts begging John to kill him anyway. He says he'll only get money for his family if he does.
You're not gonna kill me? Don't mind, I'd be released if I went along and my family would be taken care of.
Even though Crow takes John's gun and makes him shoot him, it still proves pre-crime wrong. Up until this point, John has been led on a straight path. All of his decisions in the film up to this point have been reactive. Going to see the woman who created the precogs, getting his new eyes and kidnapping Agatha were all just a means to an end. The next step in the process of clearing his name and getting his old life back. He's always believed in pre-crime itself, even after he learned about minority reports. His doubts might have grown over the course of the film, but they were always pushed to the back of his mind. But in this moment where he makes his first real decision in years, the illusion of the system completely falls apart for him. He realizes that he was set up by someone else, that everything up to this point had been planned by another man rather than destiny itself. When he makes the decision not to kill Crow, he breaks that plan and proves his own free will. It's this moment where John transcends being just another cog in the machine, and it's only by breaking free of this that he can exercise his free will. Now that John has denied what seemed like his destiny, it's proven the deterministic authoritarian system wrong, and it doesn't take long for it all to break down. The detective soon arrives at the scene. John and Agatha are long gone, but he can still see the aftermath of everything that happened. Just looking at the countless pictures of John's son on the bed tells him all he needs to know. It's all too perfect, and John was set up. But in his haste to uncover the truth, he makes a fatal mistake. He calls up the director of pre-crime that we met before and tells him that John is indeed innocent. They agree to meet at John's house, and once they're there, the detective walks him through the revelations he's managed to dig up. The echoes that Agatha was seeing of Anne Lively's murder weren't actually echoes. Instead, they were a different murder disguised to look like the previous attempts on her life. The perpetrator knew about the system and how the precogs experienced all crimes again, so he knew that if he did the same things the previous would-be killer had done, then this would all just fly under the radar. It was clearly an inside job. And as the detective explains this, it soon becomes clear that the man he's talking to was the one who'd set it all up. The safety that everyone got used to from pre-crime could have lulled him into a false sense of security. But now that Agatha's been taken by John, there isn't any way for the police to foresee murders anymore. This allows him to shoot the detective with John's gun, framing him for yet another murder while cleaning up a loose end. Meanwhile, John is still on the loose. Seeking refuge at his ex-wife's house, he realizes why Anne Lively was so important. It turns out that she was actually the mother of Agatha, the precog. It's why she kept having visions of her. But before he can use this revelation, pre-crime busts down the door. Unaware of his treachery, John's ex-wife had told the director when he arrived. It looks like all is lost. John gets haloed and imprisoned, while Agatha gets put back into the pre-crime system. The director is left to enjoy his victory. With John apparently brought to justice, his pre-crime program is destined for a nationwide rollout, which will make him the most powerful person in the country. But as he's tying up the last loose end and debriefing John's ex-wife, he makes a crucial mistake. He lets slip that he knows more about Anne Lively than he should.
I'll have Gideon round the containment files. See if anyone drowned a woman by the name.
But I never said she drowned.
It makes John's ex-wife suspicious enough to finally uncover the last piece of the puzzle. She releases John and they reveal the crimes he committed to keep the pre-crime system alive. Right at this moment of triumph, the director receives a call from John where he tells him how he did it all, while footage of his murder taken from Agatha plays on the screen. The director spots John at the party as he tries to make his escape and follows him up to the roof. Meanwhile, the precog has been put back in place and they're having another vision. This time they've seen the director murdering John. As we've seen though, people still have the potential to make their own choices. The director can either kill John and at least keep his pre-crime system going, or he could spare him and lose everything he built. And in a literal twist of fate, he decides to take his own life instead. The events that have unfolded have proved to him that his deterministic view of a controlled, safe world just isn't possible. Pre-crime is inherently flawed because of free will and the ability for people to decide their own future. In the end, we see the results of this decision. Pre-crime gets dismantled, and the people the police haloed were all set free, although lots were still under surveillance. For the whole film, we've often seen John submerged in water, struggling for air. It's where he lost his son, it's where he hid from the spiders, and it's how the precogs were forced to predict murders. It's a metaphor for how he was submerged in the system. But in one of the final shots of the film, John is finally safe and dry, watching the rain outside of his window. He's escaped from it. The technology and the tools of oppression that we've seen throughout this entire movie are gone. Agatha and the other precogs are left living a very peaceful life, completely isolated from its influence. It shows that the film is saying that human choice and human nature can't ever be truly contained. Not by technology or by any authoritarian government. That system can never truly stamp it out, and it will never truly succeed. In 1984, George Orwell wrote that, quote, "Those who control the present control the past, and those who control the past control the future." But Minority Report shows us that nobody can ever truly control the present, because people are in their nature uncontrollable. There's always a fatal flaw in any system. The government in Minority Report, which can literally extend its control into the future, is doomed from the very start. So even though we can see lots of the dystopian elements of Minority Report in today's world, the film also shows us that there will always be people willing to escape their control, make their own choices, and fight back against them.